talks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Christy Middleton, the Senior Director of Food Policy for the Humane Society of the United States, who's just published her first book, Meatless, Transform the Way You Eat and Live One Meal at a Time. In Meatless, she blends information about how much of your food is produced and by what that means for the animals from which that food is produced without being yet another harsh portrayal of factory farming conditions. Profiles of some people who've made fundamental changes in their diet and lifestyle, a few of whom oversee university dining facilities. Her own experiences, strategies for making changes, and more than 60 recipes for plant-based dishes from breakfast to soups to entrees and desserts and more. We'll hear about this book, her work for the Humane Society of the United States, how the sensibility and messaging from big animal welfare organizations has evolved over the years, and more when I play back my interview with Christy Middleton in a few moments here on Talking Animal. First, though, we're going to hear an animal song of sorts. My feeling is you can never go wrong with this one, and not just because it's the Beatles. This is Hey Diddy, Little Dog from the Beatles. Talking Animals. That was some group called the Beatles. Seem to have a bright future. With Hey Bulldog on Talking Animals. Let's move directly into my conversation with Christy Middleton, chiefly about her new book, Meatless. Recorded last week, this is Christy Middleton on Talking Animals.
Hi, Duncan. Thank you so much for having me on.
You bet. So, of course, we'll have a substantial discussion of the book. I guess I shouldn't say meaty discussion, but we'll get to the book certainly in a substantive way in a few moments. But first, let's explore some of the path you traveled to writing the book. For starters, you're currently the Senior Director of Food Policy for the Humane Society of the United States. What does that mean exactly? What does that job entail?
Right. Well, I work for the Humane Society of the United States, so we're the world's largest animal protection organization. And I think a lot of people think about our work helping cats and dogs. And we certainly do an awful lot of that. We help provide free and low-cost spay neuter services to hundreds of thousands of animals every year. We also work on wildlife issues. We end dog fighting and other animal fighting. But my team specifically works to help with improving the lives of animals who are raised for food, because they comprise the vast majority of animals who are caught up in our food system. And so we do that by, and I do that, by helping schools, hospitals, colleges and universities, and other institutions that are serving a lot of food with reducing the amount of meat they're serving and adding more plant-based options. And we're doing this because there's simply no way that we can get to that more humane society that we all dream about and continue to eat meat at our current levels.
So that sounds like a pretty ambitious undertaking. What are some specific measures or campaigns that your office and employs to try to achieve that effect?
You know, we really try to approach it through an incremental approach. So Meatless Monday, which you may have heard of before, it's a really popular campaign, and it actually has its roots back in World War I. It was initiated back then as a resource conservation campaign and then brought back during World War II for the same reason. In 2003, the Monday campaigns and the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health teamed up to revive Meatless Monday, and they did it then to fight another war, the war on chronic preventable disease. So the goal was to reduce meat consumption by about 15%, and trying to reduce your plate and your serving size by 15% can be a little bit tricky, but the idea was we could pick one day and reduce and get your week off to a healthy start, that hopefully those healthy habits will continue throughout the rest of the week. So Meatless Monday has been one intervention that institutions use, but I think we're really as a society ready for this. And so we work with schools, we've worked with some universities to start all vegan cafeterias and others to simply add more such options to their menus. But people really are excited about and ready to eat more plant-based foods, especially when they're really delicious.
We'll, I think, circle back to some of those measures, certainly including Meatless Monday, when we get into kind of more the heart of the book. What other positions have you held at the Humane Society of the United States over the years?
So when I first started working for the organization, I was working on corporate policy. So, you know, if your listeners aren't super familiar with the way that animals are raised in our food production system, I'll give a little primer and I will try to spare too many gory details. But the vast majority of eggs, for example, come from battery cages. So these are cages that are roughly the size of a desk drawer. And imagine sitting at your desk and opening that drawer and seeing 5 to 8 chickens inside. Each bird has about as much space as an iPad on which to live for roughly her 18 months or so of egg production. In these cages, the animals have no amenities. They don't have any perches, nesting boxes, anywhere to peck around. Anything that's natural are important to them. And so we have been working with corporations to help with moving from those cage systems to a cage-free system, which is more humane because it gives the animals the ability to move around. Dr. Bernie Rollin, who is a veterinarian at Colorado State University, has said that the research has showed what is very obvious, and that is that animals who are built to move should be able to move. So we've worked with corporations to give these animals those minimal considerations to be able to move around in a cage-free system. And then we've also worked to similarly alleviate the suffering of mother pigs who are confined in tiny gestation crates. And being in Tampa, you may be familiar with the ballot initiative that was passed over a decade ago that outlawed gestation crates. So these are pens that are about 2 feet wide by 7 feet long, roughly the size of a pig's body, in which pregnant pigs are confined during their gestation. and they're unable to even turn around for their entire pregnancy. They're put into another crate to give birth and then back into the gestation crate, and that cycle repeats itself over and over. And while Florida and a handful of other states have banned it, it still has been a ubiquitous practice throughout the pork industry. So we've worked with corporations to move away from those gestation crates into a more humane way of raising those breeding pigs. So when I first started with the Humane Society, I was working on corporate outreach, so working with big food companies from manufacturers to restaurant and retail companies to help them with creating policies to phase those practices out of their supply chains.
And Christy, by the way, I should quickly note that Florida is so rarely at the forefront or even somewhere in that pack that occasionally when the state is out front on an issue, it should be applauded and noted, I guess. Just
absolutely. Reason to celebrate.
Yeah. Now, but you've clearly been doing this kind of work for a number of years, and I believe you also at one point worked at PETA. And I'd just be curious to know, just generally, what sort of changes have you seen and how big organizations like PETA, like HSUS, have made in sort of addressing and promoting those kind of changes you just described, and just the corollary to that, of course, is promoting plant-based diets. What has there been an evolution of sensibility, a certain different kind of approach to messaging over the years that you could pinpoint?
You know, I think it's probably a combination of the two. So I've been an advocate for about 20 years after I learned about the suffering animals endure in our food system and through so many other channels, whether for entertainment, for our clothing. I decided that I wanted to devote my life to working in this field. So I've worked for a handful of animal protection organizations, and I think that our awareness has increased. You know, PETA's role has been traditionally to give a spotlight to these issues by getting media attention. And that's certainly how I found out about all the ways that we use and abuse animals in our society. And I think beyond that, people are animal lovers. You know, the vast majority of Americans, when polled, say that 95% of them, that animals raised for food deserve to be treated well and that they want to ensure that those animals are well taken care of. But there's this huge disparity between what we want and what animals are actually getting. And so I think by seeing documentaries like Food Inc. and Forks Over Knives and learning about our food system, or reading books like The Omnivore's Dilemma, you know, others that are New York Times best-selling books, it really has helped shed a bright spotlight on our food system and the impact that it's having on our health, on the planet, on animals. And people are demanding change. And in addition to that, of course, we're obese. You know, there are two-thirds of Americans who are overweight or obese. And it's not just a cosmetic issue. It also affects heart disease, cancer, stroke, type 2 diabetes. These prime killers of Americans. These are the top killers, and they're often food-related and preventable. And so I think people are really ready for a more humane way to treat animals and a more healthful approach to eating. In addition to that, I think that people just care about animals. So we live with them. I have four cats and a dog at home, and I think that most people who have lived with animals recognize that these are sentient beings who are capable of suffering and pain and fear, as well as joy and pleasure, and that should be extended to all animals, that we recognize that those other animals, even those who we don't live with, are capable of those feelings and those emotions, and that we should be extending compassion to them. So I've seen a tremendous amount of progress, not just in the plant-based food space, but seeing, for example, Ringling Brothers, another Florida enterprise that's closing down, but first announced that it was going to end elephant acts because of this uprising, years of campaigning by activists and the public who learned about how these majestic animals are treated and just didn't want to be part of that anymore.
A lot of unanswered questions about what's going to happen come May, but the larger point, as you've kind of alluded to, is that through a lot of concerted efforts by all kinds of individual activists to the biggest organizations and everybody in between, eventually Ringling and the Feld Entertainment folks were persuaded to remove the elephants and then remove the elephants, animals altogether. So it's a great example to point to, even if there are some significant unresolved issues about what can happen in the face of serious and sustained activism and advocacy and just educating the public. So
right, yeah, and I live in Oakland, California, which was I think the second major city to ban the bullhook after Los Angeles. And, you know, working at the municipal level, I think a lot of time we don't realize the impact that just doing something in our community can have, because then it was a domino effect in Austin, Texas, and several other cities announced that they were going to ban the bullhook, and Ringling was like, okay, we get the message, we're not going to fight this anymore. And that's when they announced that they were going to get rid of their elephant axe. So I encourage every one of your listeners to act locally, and you know this term, act locally, think globally, yeah. That being involved in our communities can really make an impact.
Well, let me let folks know this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Christy Middleton, Senior Director of Food Policy at the Humane Society of the United States and author of the new book, Meatless. This interview was recorded last week. So let's get to Meatless. When did you decide to write a book, you know, this book? What was your guiding principle? In other words, I guess one of the ways I mean that is that in recent years there have been a number of books espousing the virtues of adopting a plant-based diet. I'm sure you've read many of them in preparation for the book and just generally out of your own interest. So in pondering creating your own book, how did you decide how you'd carve a niche for yourself or that Meatless would distinguish itself from others in that same sort of literary canon?
You know, this book was really inspired by the work that I was doing, and although as I'm a 20-year vegan, and I encourage many people to consider that, that so many people who I encountered said, well, I love eating more plant-based foods, but I don't think I could ever go vegan, or I don't think I could ever go vegetarian, but I could definitely do a meatless Monday, or I could do it part of the time or be a flexitarian. And there are some wonderful books out there in this space, and there are a handful of, like, Vegan Before Six by Mark Bittman, and Lean In by, or The Lean by Kathy Freston, but not a whole lot that were really addressing this idea that you can do a little bit, you can do what's comfortable for you without having that pressure of going 100% vegetarian or vegan. And maybe people will decide to do that after reading the book, but I wanted to really have this approach that felt like you can dip your toes in the water without the pressure of becoming vegetarian or vegan, because I recognize that even for me, it was a gradual process. So I became vegetarian when I was in college, and I describe this in the book after a college marketing professor provided examples of euphemisms, and she shared, the one that she shared was meat. If we, instead of calling it meat, which is this tidy package, we called it what it really is, which is the flesh of animals, the flesh of dead animals. And so I became vegetarian, but then it wasn't for several years after that that I learned about factory farming and decided to become vegan. And oftentimes after we learn this, we feel like we want everybody in the world to know it, and we want everybody in the world to just become vegan overnight, but that's not really plausible for a lot of people. I have friends who did that. I have other friends who still eat meat and eat meatless on Mondays. And so I really wanted an approach that would give people permission to do what feels right for them, that you don't have to go 100%, 80%, 50% is a really good start and will make a big impact on your health, on the planet, and on animals.
Yeah, so it sounded like one of the things that you did want to do to kind of carve out a little different path for your book is conceive the book with sort of that kinder, gentler sensibility that changes of the kind that you just mentioned here, but sort of obviously go into in great detail in the book, can be gradual, and people shouldn't feel bad, guilty, crummy, whatever, if they're not learning some information, then diving in feet first the next day to becoming vegan. And so at one point early on, I think you recall in the book your own transition. As you noted a moment ago, you became a vegetarian in college, but that your own transition to a plant-based diet was a slow one. Does that kind of help account just what your own path was in that regard for the allowances that you kind of make repeatedly in this book for encouraging change, but just noting people should move at their own pace and not feel crummy about doing so?
Yeah, absolutely. And as I said, you know, I do have a couple of friends who became vegan overnight. They learned the information and they took action on it. But I feel like by and large, that's not the path for a lot of people. Some people will stop eating chicken and beef and then eventually cut eggs and dairy out of their diet, or take whatever route it makes sense for them to get there. So I think that was definitely one thing that led me to writing the book in this way. I also talked to many people as I was interviewing and found, one gentleman who I talked with, Anthony Williams, shared with me that he had tried going vegetarian cold turkey with his wife and, it didn't stick the first time, and then the next time they were going to cut back, and I think, you know, again, go cut back and then lead up to vegetarian. And then they ended up learning about Meatless Monday, and they found that worked for them, because what they had been doing before is once they fell off the wagon, they were like, okay, we can't do this. And then they just went all the way back to eating meat, you know, sometimes three times a day. And they found that doing a gradual approach, a Meatless Monday, and then doing one additional meal, like every single day, they would have at least one meat-free meal. And then all day Monday, it was meatless. That worked for them. And then I followed up with him just a month ago and let him know the book was on the way. And he shared that he's still sticking with that and actually doing even more. So I've found that this actually has really helped people with sticking to their goals. In addition, there's research out there on recidivism. Vegetarians who become vegetarian and then they slide back into eating meat or going back to whatever their old diets were. And they found that really people who had done it gradually and gone vegetarian or vegan gradually were the ones who stuck with it. And so I'm a real big proponent of that, you know, leaning in and dipping your toes in the water approach for that reason. As well, you know, the book dives into some of the other barriers to change. So in addition to the way that you dive into it, it also examines what are some of the problems, like why is it so hard for us to make any kind of diet change or any change in general? And our community is such a huge influencer of how we eat. So there's a researcher, Walter Willett, who is the number one quoted nutrition expert in the world. He's the chair of the School of Nutrition for Harvard University. And he talks in his book, it's called Thinfluence, that if we have a close friend who is obese, then we are 57% more likely to be obese, because we eat like our community does. And I can certainly attest to this. If a friend orders dessert, I'm like, oh, okay, I guess I'll order dessert too, right? But if we have communities and friends who are eating healthy, or if they're trying to do Meatless Monday with us, or they're eating vegan with us, then we're much more likely to be successful. And so I recommend trying to get a friend or family member to join you on this journey, because that will help with ensuring your success.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, a book like this, I think, is valuable on a number of levels. I mean, there's great information and research that you cite from various sources. But I think for any kind of enterprise, someone's personal story, people can really grab onto and relate on some level, even if they don't share the exact same things. So right out of the gate with Meatless, you come with this kind of striking story about how changing a diet can change a life. I'm speaking about Eric O'Gray. Maybe you could talk a little bit about Eric O'Gray and his story.
Yeah, so Eric has an incredible story. He was very overweight, and he talks about, you know, being on an airplane and having to ask for seatbelt extensions. And he was really sick, and his doctor told him that if he didn't want to start looking for cemetery plots, that he had to make a transition in his diet. And so he decided that he was going to become vegan after reading some books, but he didn't cook. He said that most of his meals before deciding to make this transition had been purchased through a drive-thru. You know, he wasn't really thinking about where his food came from. He was severely overweight and sometimes couldn't, you know, walk up the stairs without getting winded. And so he purchased the book, The China Study, which for your listeners who aren't familiar with it, it's really about the link between chronic preventable diseases and nutrition. And, you know, unfortunately, doctors are not sharing enough with us these days about nutrition and how much of an impact our diets can have on our health. And so he then started working with a dietitian who helped advise him on the sorts of foods that he should eat. He also adopted a dog, Petey, from the local shelter, and he started walking with Petey every single day, and Petey and his newfound diet helped him with losing over 100 pounds. He ended up then getting off of all of his high blood pressure medication, his lipids, and other medications, and then he started running races. He started running marathons. I mean, this is a guy who, again, couldn't even go up the stairs without getting winded and later was running marathons, something that he wouldn't have believed he would be able to do just a few years prior to this. And he continues running to this day and is really the model for health if you see him. And unfortunately, Petey passed a couple of years ago, but he's recently adopted another dog, Jake, and they actually are an internet sensation. There was a beautiful video that was put out by the Seattle, I believe it was the Seattle TV station, and the Seattle Humane Society. Anyway, it's become viral, and now he has his own book that will hopefully be coming out, I believe, in the fall of this year.
It's great, and Eric's story is inspirational on a number of levels and kind of has at least a twofer in there that he made those changes and really saw a whole body and health and everything transform. But not unrelated to that, the fact that he adopted a dog, and that was part of what helped him get healthy and fit, kind of had an extra bonus for those of us who love and care about animals. So yeah, so that was, I thought, a great story, sort of multiple directions. And then, again, let me let folks know, by the way, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Christy Middleton, whose new book is entitled Meatless. That's the book we're discussing at the moment. This interview was recorded last week. Another story kind of along the lines of Eric that thought wielded tremendous impact on at least a couple of levels was Ken Chadwick's. Maybe you could discuss both his story and the overlapping professional challenges that he faced in his job.
Right, yes. Ken is another phenomenal example. So he is the food service director for American University in Washington, D.C., and I met him through my work with helping institutions with adding more plant-based options to their menus. And one of my colleagues held an event at his university. That was the first time that we'd actually met. So the event that I went to was sort of post all of the story that I'm about to tell, and it was to laud him for the great work that he was doing there. So he had worked in food services for decades at some of the most prestigious universities in Washington, D.C. So he was familiar with requests from students to have more vegetarian and vegan options on their menus. But he had been raised in Chile and Argentina, and he shared that he spent his formative years working on his grandparents' cattle ranch. And he was a real meat and potatoes, minus the potatoes, kind of guy. He loved eating meat. And so when his students kept asking for vegetarian and vegan options, he would just say, we have a beautiful salad bar. But as he shared, you know, here's this ardent carnivore trying to meet the needs of vegetarian students. The best that he could do wasn't even close. And so during a student advisory committee meeting, when students were saying, again, that they wanted more vegan options, he decided as of that day, he was going to become vegan. He had no idea what he was signing up for. And so the next day, his first day eating vegan, he says, was an all-pear day, because really the only thing that he could eat was hand fruit. Because, as I should mention, he decided he was not going to eat from the salad bar, since that was what he had always suggested to students that they do. So he teamed up with his dietitian and the chefs on campus, who also decided to become vegan with him, at least temporarily. And they created vegan options that would be delicious, nutritious, and really filling for breakfast, lunch, or dinner, because sometimes they eat all three on campus. And so the students really quickly started benefiting. But then Ken also saw the benefits. He started dropping weight really fast. So I should mention that he had been over 300 pounds at the time, and he was on blood pressure medication. He was on cholesterol-lowering drugs. And he had to have his gallbladder removed a couple of years prior. And the doctor was actually afraid he was going to die on the surgical table because he was so overweight and unhealthy. But the new vegan diet started helping him lose weight. He saw the weight dropping off so quickly that his staff started calling him the incredible shrinking man. And when he went back home to visit his mom that Christmas, so this all started in September. He went back home at Christmas. She almost couldn't recognize him because that's how quickly the weight came off. So Ken eventually was able to get off of his medication, and to this day he continues eating a mostly vegan diet. And, you know, I think that his approach is a sound one. It works for him. And what he does is if he's on campus, he eats vegan. If he's at home, he eats mostly vegan. But if he shared soft shell crabs are his thing, and if they're in season, which is for just a couple of weeks each year, then he might have one, or he might eat a piece of cheese here and there. But he eats mostly vegan, and it's really helped make his approach to eating more mindful, because he used to just slam food in his mouth, as he shared, and that's not the way he approaches food anymore. He thinks a lot more about where it comes from and the impact that it's had along the way. And he says he doesn't really think about it, whether or not it's healthy, but most of the food he eats tends to be healthy anyway. And he still continues to exercise these days. He runs 6 miles and then goes boxing without even becoming tired. So this diet has had a profound impact on his health. And of course, as a major champion now of plant-based foods, his university is one of the best out there, serving more meat-free meals. They do Meatless Monday, and they also worked with the Humane Society to create a plant-based restaurant on campus.
Now, along those lines, to pick one more from a number that are sprinkled throughout the book, I guess this would be sort of constitute a tale of two Kens, but I guess because of the exponential impact involved, I also found myself interested in, like, Ken Chadwick's story, Ken Bott's story, the idea that whatever they're going through personally, that they're also responsible for serving meals to hundreds or thousands of college students. So Ken Bott's created the nation's first vegan dining hall. So maybe you could address that a little bit and just kind of what the upshot was, because I thought that was, again, an interesting story, and the ripple effect was quite wide.
Absolutely. So I'm so fortunate now to call Ken Bott a colleague, but I met Ken first when he was at the University of North Texas, and at the time, we had worked together on getting more cage-free eggs on their menus and moving away from those battery cage eggs I talked about earlier. And his students at the University of North Texas, which is in Denton, Texas, about 30 miles or so north of Dallas, so in the heart of beef country, not exactly where you would think of a hotbed of animal activism happening, but they had seen a lot of requests for more vegan options from students. And they have 5 dining halls on campus. It's a huge commuter campus with about 35 to 40,000 students, a pretty big school. And they had these 5 dining halls with one that was underperforming. It was getting about 175 transactions per day. And so they decided to do something that was a bit different, and that was to make this dining hall a vegan dining hall. And they called it Mean Greens. And so Ken teamed up with the wonderful chef Wanda White, and they created a menu that was full of all kinds of delicious, often southern comfort foods, but just amazing food in general that would appeal to all of their guests, whether they eat meat or they're vegetarians or vegans. And they opened this dining hall. It had lines out the door. They got over $165,000 in free publicity because publications like USA Today and ABC News were writing about what they were doing there. It went from 175 transactions to over 700 to over 1,000 very quickly, and it also had an impact on their meal plan sales. So meal plans is how the university dining halls make money, and they got volunteer meal plans. So from students who were commuting or faculty and staff, they started purchasing more meal plans. And if you go into Mean Greens, 9 out of 10 of the customers would say that they're not vegetarian or vegan. They're just there because the food is great.
Found that, I mean, the whole tale I thought was great, but I found that such a striking detail because, again, you're talking about college kids, you're talking about serving a lot of people, a lot of meals in a given day, and that what they created with Mean Greens, the fact that only a tenth of the constituency identified as vegetarian or vegan, yet they loved it, and that's where they ate every day, multiple meals in many cases, just because the food tasted so good. I just found that really fantastic.
Yeah, it makes it much easier. So now both Ken and Wanda are on my team at the Humane Society, and we are trying to help with replicating their success at UNT with universities, hospitals, and other institutions all across the country. So hopefully we can come to your community as well and help get some delicious plant-based food on the menu.
And how does that work exactly? Just as a sort of a little tangent here, Christy, but I'm just curious in light of what you just said there. Do you guys regularly approach college and university dining offices and say, hey, we can help this, here's what we've done, here's the track record, or do you only just respond when those kind of places approach you, or how does that work?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. It used to be us knocking at doors, and now I would say we're getting an onslaught of requests, both from word-of-mouth referrals or from meeting people at conferences. So Ken and Wanda are on the road. They are real road warriors. They're on the road almost every single week. Last week, they were in New York and Pittsburgh and probably somewhere else in between. I can't keep up with their travel schedules,
yeah.
But there's a lot of demand. And it's really fascinating to see these conferences. What they do is they go and do two-day conferences or events with universities where we call them food-forward culinary experiences, where we get in the kitchen with chefs and other culinary professionals, and we show them how to cook plant-based food. We team them up together and share recipes, and Chef Wanda does some demos to showcase some of the things that they may not realize can easily be made vegan. And then they go back to their stations and they create breakfast, lunch, dinner, and dessert. And then we all dine together. And it's really fun to see them go from a bit skeptical at first to taking pictures of their food and at the end of the day sharing how they think they could eat vegan some of the time, or, you know, maybe I could do this at home. So it's really amazing to see that the transition that happens when people taste delicious food, because I think for a lot of people, it's really just overcoming that hurdle of what's familiar and how easily it can be made vegan. Whether it's something like an eggplant parmesan, which is Wanda's signature dish, to bananas Foster, which is another amazing dessert that she makes. These are foods that are familiar with slight variations that can easily make them vegan.
Again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Christy Middleton, whose new book is entitled Meatless. This interview was recorded last week. So, Chris, a hallmark of the book, as I've kind of noted, is that, and even in the way some of the things that you've outlined in our conversation here, is a very sort of open and flexible, certainly non-judgmental approach to encouraging change in people. And so if they just go with Meatless Monday, maybe initially or on an ongoing basis, that's great with you. If they go further than that, that's great. If they go kind of all the way but occasionally have soft shell crabs, that seems like okay. So now, obviously, I think we all know that there was a school of thought that's that has a very different take on this, that deals more in absolutes, and sometimes, of course, that's expressed in books and films and other things. How do you feel about the other view and what that does relative to the efforts that you're promoting in terms of encouraging people to make changes gradually or incrementally or just small changes here and there?
You know, Duncan, I can completely relate, because once I became vegan, I really wanted everyone to know the reasons why I was vegan, and, you know, talk to my parents and they would tell you, you know, I sort of took that really dogmatic route. But over the years, I've learned that it's just not that black and white. It's not that cut and dry, and that we should try to meet people where they're at, because our eating habits are so caught up in so many things. I mean, we can talk about all kinds of things, but talk to people about what they should and shouldn't eat, and you really get them fired up. And so, you know, what I found, again, is that gradual approach, the Meatless Monday, that if you talk to 7 people and ask them to go vegetarian, probably you're not going to get a taker. Maybe you would, but we talk to 7 people and ask them to do a Meatless Monday, I would guess that most people would say, yes, I could do that. So you get 7 people to do a Meatless Monday, then that's kind of the equivalent of a vegetarian, right? So I think that we have to look at things from a practical approach.
Yeah.
And if we ask people to reduce, then it can add up to make a big difference. And I'm seeing that approach really taking root. And from some people who are starting with a Meatless Monday, I've heard anecdotally from many that have said, you know, I just really needed to start, and then once I got started, now I've become vegetarian, or I'm vegan now. So I think it can help people with making the overall transition, but making it gradual works better for some folks.
Well, I just guess I'm thinking, for example, a recent guest on the show was Robert Grillo of Free From Harm, whose new book is Farm to Fable, The Fictions of Our Animal-Consuming Culture. And it's sort of an ambitious philosophical treatise about a lot of this sort of imaging and messaging and things that go on. But, I mean, certainly I would say not making much allowance for incremental changes or expressing kind of disdain, for example, I think, for Meatless Mondays or Vegan Before mm-hmm. 6 and other measures, which, again, that's the focus of his take and his philosophical underpinnings of the book. It's just interesting that these are fairly juxtaposed in terms of your book and his book. And again, there's all kinds of things just conversationally and online and in messages and you know, Facebook and everywhere about the different approaches. But it sounds like, just from your experience personally and professionally, that you feel that, hey, people do what they can do, and let's encourage whatever that is, and not have it be any kind of punitive thing or guilt-inducing thing. And I think the recidivism that you talked about is a key component of this.
Right, absolutely. And I think you can look to what's now happening in our food movement. So, for example, Breyers Ice Cream now has a vegan ice cream. Ben and Jerry's started one last year. Tyson's Foods, the world's biggest meat company, is now buying stock in Beyond Meat, and they've even created their own venture capital fund that's going to be investing in more plant-based food companies. So we are seeing more interest in that space. But if we went to Tyson and said, shut down and go vegan, you know, we'd probably be laughed out of the building. So I think encouraging people, it's about progress. It's not about perfection. I think that's a route that most people would find acceptable.
Yeah, well, and again, I think it's how that information is presented and where. I mean, I think, I'd like to think, and I've certainly heard over the years, that a show like this that covers all kinds of animals and all kinds of animal issues has, I've heard from people, had some impact in persuading people to go vegan, or at the very least to, if they're maybe, especially if they're pretty heavy meat eaters, to embrace Meatless Monday or embrace some other changes, which, again, I applaud. I think if you listen to this kind of show as opposed to, I mean, you know, vegan-oriented shows or podcasts are fantastic in many cases, but also kind of preaching to the converted and unlikely to inspire as much change as sort of a more general show where if it's not shrill or preachy and just encourages people to try some things, and especially if they like what they try, if they like the recipes, if they like this Ben and Jerry's ice cream, I can't believe this is considered vegan, this is delicious, or whatever it might be, pretty soon you've got people heading down that path in whatever way that they can.
Absolutely. Well, congratulations for that, because it's a real testament to your approach, I think, in making it where here's the information and do with it what you will. And I can attest to the fact that I think that really works quite well for people. You know, I have family members who know that I'm vegan, and we have many other family members who are vegetarian and vegan, but then who watched a film like Forks Over Knives, and then the light bulb went off for them because they came to the information on their own. So you're presenting information, and you're sharing, you know, you're talking with people who are talking about animal behavior, or who are, you know, rappers talking about cats, and it's, all of these different approaches that I think help shed light onto the fact that animals are sophisticated, interesting, inquisitive beings who have their own preferences and really just the desire to live and to be left to their own devices, and that, you know, everything that we do when we sit down to eat has an impact on them, or whatever else the industry is that you're talking about. So a real shout out to you for the amazing work that you're doing for helping.
Well, yeah, I didn't mean to go down that path. I just meant as an example that, because again, it's gradual, but like you say, if it's a cat wrapper 1 week, a dog trainer or something, a scientist that the next week, and then something about factory farming or about the virtues of plant-based diet, I think people will listen and take in what they can and make the changes that they can, versus maybe something that's a little less, you know, broad or less dimensional than that. But that's just kind of what I've been hearing and what I've experienced over the years of doing this show. But with that in mind, since we just have a minute or two left here, Chrissy, let's talk about the recipes in the book, because we've talked about some of the cool stories and research and other inspirational aspects. But let's talk about, there's some 60 or thereabouts recipes that you've included here that could also encourage people to say, well, you know, I'm not so sure about this kind of food, but maybe I'll try this or I'll try that, and then they may be very pleasantly surprised. So let's, maybe you can name two or three particular favorite recipes. First of all, how did you decide on these 60 particulars, since there probably could have been an endless number that you that you've loved and made over the years?
Right. Well, these are some of my favorite recipes, and then I also invited Chef Alex Burry, who is a chef who was trained at the Culinary Institute of America and the Food and Beverage Institute. So she got training from both the CIA and the FBI. And she shared some of her favorite recipes. And Alex and I have worked together for a number of years. She now works for Vegan Outreach, but she's got this incredible background in culinary. And so we worked together over the years, and some of these recipes were some of the most popular ones from some of the demos that we did together, like a Rockin' Reuben. So really simple, familiar food that's very easily made plant-based, and the sauce on the Reuben you could put on almost anything and it would be delicious. I also wanted to share some of my own favorites from my kitchen. So a cashew cheese that's made and the food processor takes just a couple of minutes to make, and you can pour it over macaroni and cheese or some pasta to make a delicious fettuccine Alfredo. So really simple foods that I think will shock people by their ease and also by how delicious they are. And then we've got a few desserts in the back from Chef Alex, like a pineapple upside down cake and royal hot fudge that you could pour over your new vegan Ben and Jerry's ice cream. Yeah. So some really delicious yet simple foods that I wanted to make sure would be accessible for both the Julia child in the kitchen or people who are home cooks but may not know their way around the kitchen so well.
Well, that's the thing. There's a great variety, and again, it's breakfast, handheld soups, entrees, sides and sauces, desserts, so kind of any and all categories are covered by at least a handful, and in some cases quite a large handful of great-sounding recipes. So a couple things. One, before we have to say goodbye here, Chrissy, one is that with Chef Burry's background in cooking and working for both the CIA, FBI. I wonder if she has any insights about whether President Obama did tap President Trump's phone. But otherwise, I also want to let folks know again that the name of the new book is Meatless, and it's available wherever you get your books. This has been Christy Middleton that we've been speaking with. And Christy, thanks so much for making the time to join us on Talking Animals, and good luck with the book and all your great work at Humane Society of the United States.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure, and I look forward to hopefully talking again in the future.
Great. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Duncan.
My thanks again to Christy Middleton. This is Talking Animals. Right now it's time to step into the comedy corner. This guy, Joe Zimmerman, has become one of my absolute faves in recent years, and I was delighted to see him publish a great essay in the New York Times a couple weeks ago. Here's Joe Zimmerman with a piece I'm calling Crows. In today's comedy corner on Talking Animals.
I'm mad at Google right now. I had an important question to ask, and I remember typing in, what is my... Before I could finish, the thing that Google suggested was spirit animal? And I was like, yeah, what is it? Because you see other people and you know, right? You're like, toucan. But nobody's ever told me mine, so I'm genuinely taking this online spirit animal quiz, hoping I'm a chocolate lab. I don't know if I've ever been more disappointed than to learn I'm a crow. I thought these were supposed to be fun. Congrats, you're the scavenger bird. You're defensive. The crow likes laughing and eating. Everybody likes laughing and eating. It's almost like these internet quizzes are just making stuff up. I was aggravated, like a crow would be. So I went back to Google, looked up second opinion online spirit animal quiz. Like, no way I'm a crow twice. This time I'm basically lying, trying to get chocolate lab. Like, love snuggling and being rescued. Come on. Quiz number two told me I'm a cricket. That's not even an animal, that's an insect. I don't want a spirit bug. So now crow's starting to sound pretty good. Now I'm researching more about crows to learn a little bit more about my people. Typing into Google, are crows cool? And short version, they are. They are cool. I recommend them. Crows recognize individual human faces. I know you guys are like, this guy's not going to keep talking about crows, is he? But I kind of need to. I'll sum up the study real quick. Basically, a scientist was mean to a crow and then released it, waited to see if the crow remembered him. Not only did it remember him, but it was like, I hate you. And then it surprised him when it told other crows, and it could point him out in a crowd. It was like, that dude's cool, that dude's cool, that's the dude. And then those crows spread the word to even more crows. They were like, that's the man who bullied Jonathan. That doesn't sound that crazy, because we also recognize other human faces. That'd be the equivalent of us recognizing an individual crow's face. Like, there he is. That's the one who stole my windowsill pie. So don't mess with crows, because they're smart, they hold grudges, and groups of crows are called murders. You know what groups of people are called? Groups. I'll tell you who else holds a grudge. Crow Zimmerman.
That was Joe Zimmerman with a piece, not surprisingly, called Crows, taken from an appearance on Conan. Coming up at 11 on WMNF, it's Rob Lori and Radioactivity. Rolling in the new hour, constitutes a full 2 hours of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, with contributions from members of the stellar WMNF staff including, of course, Everyday Ethics with Craig Kahn. Meanwhile, as the prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a Talking Animals t-shirt. Right now, it's time for some animal news and announcements. And just as a heads up, we'll do Name That Animal Tune today by email rather than the usual phone call. But let's get to a couple of tidbits, animal news and announcements. First of all, I meant to get to this last week and we ran out of time, but still notable, I think. This is from the AP, from Dateline Anchorage, Alaska. Fourth dog associated with this year's Iditarod Trail sled dog race has died. Race marshal Mark Nordman says in a release that a four-year-old male named Flash collapsed and died while it was running with Kota Zebu musher Catherine Keith's team about 10 miles outside the checkpoint in Koyuk. Three other dogs have also died since the race started. This was back on March 6th in Fairbanks, including one on a team belonging to Keith's partner, former champion John Baker of Kota Zebu. The dog had been dropped from Baker's team and returned to Anchorage. Iditarod officials released the dog to a handler Saturday, and the dog got loose later that night from the handler's home. The body was found Sunday in Anchorage, and it appeared it had been hit by a car. Two dogs died the previous week, including one that was flown back to Anchorage from a checkpoint. Necropsy showed signs that the dog suffered from hypothermia, but further tests were being conducted. The other dog died near the checkpoint in Galena. And the necropsy found abnormalities, but not the cause of death. So, all right, Iditarod, say what you will. Seems rough. Rough on the dogs. Hey, more upbeat by a long shot, and locally to boot, the 30th annual Bark in the Park is happening this Saturday, March 25th. That's the Humane Society of Tampa Bay's big annual blowout. 30 years now that they've been doing it. Happens at Curtis Hickson Park, again, this Saturday the 25th from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. And all kinds of cool stuff. Adoptions, craft beer and wine, food trucks, live music, VIP pre-event, VIP tent with mimosas and sweets, 70 pet-friendly vendors, celebrities, MCs from Fox 13, Doggy Pop Park for off-leash playtime, and more. So, you can go to barkintheparktampa.com to register, or you can just go to humanesocietytampa.org to find out more info. I'm Douglas Rush. You're listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to Name That Animal Tune. This is a giveaway, but please only participate if you haven't won something from WNF in the last 90 days. And there'll be a prize, a Talking Animals t-shirt, to the first person who emails. Please don't call today, but email your guess to Duncan@WMNF.org and be the first to correctly identify this animal song. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals. I think you'll be able to get this one. Let's see. Well, think you can name that animal tune? If so, again, the first to correctly do so by emailing Duncan@WMNF.org wins a fabulous Talking Animals t-shirt. Hey, we just have reached about the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Rob Laura is up next. We announced 2 hours of radioactivity. I'll be back next Wednesday, March 29th, when my guest will be Stephen Wells, the executive director of the Animal Legal Defense Fund. 2 days later, on March 31st, he'll be in Tampa speaking at Stetson University about careers in animal law. So hope you'll join us for that. Meanwhile, please visit talkinganimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. iTunes podcasts are available there, too. There are also links to the Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. Please like us on Facebook. The show, of course, is great, but also if you friend me personally, you'll probably get even more information the way things are set up on good old Facebook. And also, please follow me on Twitter. You can also subscribe to our e-newsletter to find out more about things happening in the Talking Animals world, including usually a couple of days heads up on our guests for that week. That's all found at talkinganimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. As usual, we're closing out today's show with an animal song. This one of the instrumental variety. This is Jethro Tull with their version of Serenade to a Cuckoo on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachee, and beyond. Community Conscious Radio. Thanks for listening. See you again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks. Thank you.